You're listening to episode 179 of the Marathon Running Podcast. In this episode, we're going to talk about doping in marathoning. This is the Marathon Running Podcast by Letty and Ryan from We Got the Runs. Join us in our running community for weekly content that is motivational, educational, and inspirational, and let the Marathon Running Podcast take you from the starting line to the finish line and beyond. Hey runners, and welcome to episode 179. My name is Letty.
My name is Ryan.
Welcome back if you're a longtime listener, and bear with us here for a minute because we're going to take some time to welcome all of our new listeners. So we're doing that because we are expecting a few new listeners. We started advertising on the Marathon Training Academy as well as Spotify. We are always happy about new listeners because we have so much to share. Our podcast has been growing. So again, if you are new, welcome.
Letty, you want to give us a little history of the podcast?
Yeah. So I started this podcast almost 4 years ago. Our original name was We Got the Runs, and Ryan loved that name.
I thought it was funny just because it matches your personality perfect.
Not that I have the runs a lot, but I have a lot of sarcasm and that type of humor in me. Ryan always says I have the humor of a 12-year-old boy.
Sometimes, yes. And no, not because of the runs.
My first half year going to university, I was a declared advertising major. It didn't last, but I do remember little things such as you kind of have to put out there, unless you have a big name, you have to put out there what you do. Nobody is going to Google having the runs and running. And that was that for We Got the Runs. Now we still use We Got the Runs, but it's just the name of the LLC that we use to hold our running business. So the change of name helped the podcast grow a lot. It is not our full-time job, however. I am a lawyer by trade. Ryan is a medical doctor. But this podcast is our pride and joy, and we love watching it grow.
And some history about Letty. She grew up in Germany. That's why sometimes she says things that are a little different. I don't know if there people others say it here, but they say, like, you know, I went to the university. Most people just don't say that, but...
Oh, well, there we go. We try to keep it lighthearted, as we already mentioned, and fun, but we do bring on some serious guests, like seriously amazing guests, but also serious guests. So if you stick with us, you'll see that we don't pretend to be experts, but rather we want to connect the running community and bring on the experts and deliver information with good sources if we can. So
I think that was a good summary. So what's going on this week?
Yeah, so in this week's podcast, we are going to talk about doping in marathoning. Why? Because everybody is talking about it. There's been a lot of records, and we by no means are alleging that any of these phenomenal runners are doping, but there is a lot of talk about it. So we figured let's educate ourselves a little bit about what all that means.
I think that anytime you have like people breaking records, which they happened recently, then people always look into it like, oh, why? You know, why are they breaking records all of a sudden? And you can look in the past on other things. Like I know in the Olympics 1 year, they had swimming where they had a full body suit and everyone was breaking records there. And then they actually banned it afterwards. And in running recently, they had shoes, you know, that became like too high of the cushion pad or too many carbon plates or something. And then they ended up banning those. But, you know, people are always looking for reasons why, you know, people are breaking records. And the other thing is potentially doping. So some people have been talking about that, like taking drugs in order to improve their performance. So we thought we'd try to seek out the people responsible for catching the dopers and just see if they would be willing to talk to us. As much as everyone wants to think that all the athletes are pure and nobody ever tries to cheat, you know, it does definitely happen and they occasionally catch people. So Letty, you researched some cases of people getting caught doping recently, right?
Yeah, so we have one of, this guy used to be the sixth fastest marathoner in the world, Titus Ekuru. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but he is a 31-year-old Kenyan, and he tested positive and tried to manipulate the health records from the hospital where he was tested. So that's really unfortunate. And one that is actually a little bit more close to my heart, that was when I ran my very first Boston in 2021, back when they had that first October marathon after the pandemic. The female winner, Diana Kipyoke of Kenya, she had tested positive for doping, obviously, afterwards. So while I was at Boston. They did her award ceremony and all that stuff that could have gone to the next runner. So I feel like while it's not fair, it's also sad to see the runner up not being able to be in the light of, you know, they work so hard and they do it hopefully cleanly. And then they don't even get that publicity that can help them also in so many ways with sponsorships and everything else.
Yeah, I feel like it's always a game back and forth between the people trying to catch the dopers and the people doing the performance enhancing.
Right. Runs. And yeah, so then, you know, I wanted to know more about it. I reached out to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Shout out to Tucker Pettigrew, who is the communications coordinator, who got back to me and was able to coordinate this amazing chat with USADA Director of Science, Dr. Laura Lewis. I asked her a lot of questions, very basic questions to get some good definitions, such as what is doping? How is doping done most commonly? What do we do about doping, given that those marathons take place in different places of the world? Who is in charge of what? What procedures are in place for monitoring this and all this in terms of the sport of marathoning? Also, I asked her about the gray zone. The gray zone is a term that people that have researched doping a little bit might have heard about it. So she's going to explain that and some more.
That sounds really cool. Actually, I'm interested too. So let's get into it.
All right. So without any further ado, we're now going to play our conversation with Dr. Laura Lewis. All right, so I'm on here with Laura Lewis. Laura, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. And for our audience, can you please tell us who you are and what you do at the agency?
Yeah, so I am the Director of Science at USADA, so the US Anti-Doping Agency. We're the national anti-doping organization that's responsible for the testing of Olympic and Paralympic athletes in the US. So in my role as director of science, I work with pretty much every single team in the organization through from education, helping to, you know, educate athletes on the rules regarding anti-doping, but also with our testing teams to work out who we're going to test with what test and ensure that, you know, we're testing the right people at the right time. And then I also provide scientific advice to our legal team in the event that an athlete does test positive and there's, you know, various scientific questions regarding that case.
Perfect. So we are in good hands here with our questions. And I want to start with something very basic. So I've sent you the questions before. I want to go to question number two, just doping as a term that we often hear, but maybe you can give us a clear definition and then maybe go into a little bit of what doping means when it comes to the sport of marathon running, what type of doping there is and what is considered doping.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess really broadly speaking, doping refers to the use of a prohibited substance or a prohibited method or technique, which serves to enhance performance. So for marathon runners, it's something that you might take or you might do to your body to increase your performance. Now, that might be performance in training so that ultimately you can perform better on race day, or it might be something that you specifically do around a competition to make sure that you run faster at the end of the day. So that's really important for people to know that athletes who do choose to dope might do it far away from competition just to get that competitive edge in terms of their training. So a lot of the practices that we might hear about in the context of marathon running are particularly around blood doping. And so that's increasing the red blood cells and the amount of hemoglobin in those red blood cells that carry oxygen around your body, enabling you to perform at a higher level. You'd both be more efficient when you are running, but also able to run faster. And ways that athletes might blood dope would be either taking an erythropoietic stimulating agents. And I know that sounds quite a lot of complicated words there, but that just basically means stimulating your body to produce more red blood cells. And the most famous erythropoietic stimulating agent that we know of is erythropoietin, or EPO. So injecting EPO can stimulate your body to produce these red blood cells in a more accelerated time frame. The other way that you could increase the number of red blood cells you have is to infuse a bag of blood, and that could either be from your own body that you'd taken out several months earlier, weeks or months earlier, or by using somebody else's blood that they've donated to you. So all of those practices, the erythropoietic stimulating agents, or the infusions of blood, they are all prohibited in sport and considered doping. Now, there's some other substances that can improve performance that aren't, you know, don't fall under that blood doping umbrella. And they are all listed on the WADA prohibited list. But these might be things that, you know, stimulate your body to produce energy, or to help with recovery, or to help with general oxygen intake in terms of, you know, some asthma medications, if you didn't have asthma, like might help to enhance performance. So there's a lot of different ways that, unfortunately, if somebody did want to dope in marathon running, they have quite a gamut of options to choose from.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It doesn't sound so black and white as if someone were to just take a pill, say you take an illegal substance and you can simply just test for it. So for blood doping and somebody increasing their red blood cells, and it being something that naturally could occur if they live at higher altitude, how do you guys test for that? And then also, what's kind of the timeline for testing for something like that for American marathon events? Like, do they have to let you know when they're signing up and then you do random tests, or how does that all work?
Yeah, so I guess to start with the first part of that question of how we would detect blood doping per se, I'm not sure if you've heard of the Athlete's Biological Passport, or the ABP. But that's a way of indirectly detecting blood doping. And what it involves is collecting a series of blood tests from an athlete over the length of their career, and looking for changes in their patterns, because our bodies are, you know, pretty in tune, and they like to stay in this kind of homeostatic, steady kind of state. And so the ABP uses a mathematical model to predict what the normal range would be for that athlete. So it allows for upper, you know, fluctuations up or down in certain parameters. As quite rightly you said, you know, if you went to altitude, and your body might naturally increase. So those are taken into account. But if there's a sudden change up or down, which creates known patterns that are associated with blood doping, this kind of raises a red flag. And, you know, we will look into that, and a group of independent experts will look into that to see if there is a normal explanation. Perhaps there's a medical condition that could describe that. But if there isn't, then the athlete will be approached to provide an explanation. And following that explanation, if there's still not a reasonable scientific explanation for these changes, then athletes can actually be sanctioned. And worldwide, we're looking at about 200 athletes now that have been sanctioned using the ABP model, which is based on, you know, this indirect detection of blood doping. So for our top American athletes, they'd be part of USADA's registered testing pool, and that will require them to provide whereabouts to USADA so that we can test them out of competition. And we will start to build up this ABP profile, which documents their normal. At some of these major marathons, they may also be selected for pre-competition testing, which is, you know, usually occurs in the 2 to 3 days before the race, and they will have their blood collected and that will be added to their profile. And, you know, for the vast majority of athletes, this profile is just ticking away, just documenting their normal state. In addition, there will be in-competition testing, but that's usually in the form of a urine sample. And in those tests, that's when we're really looking for those specific substances like the EPOs or testosterones or steroids or those kinds of things.
Are you looking for the perfect apparel that mirrors your love for running? Look no further than Run Swag, the go-to store by runners for runners. From witty tees to hoodies that commemorate your marathon majors to crops that get you motivated, Run Swag's got you covered. Discover the perfect blend of comfort and style. Visit www.runswag.com. Run Swag, there's something for every runner.
Okay, perfect. Thanks for explaining that. And let me just backtrack a little bit, because I'm thinking about a competition that will occur in the United States, say something like the Chicago Marathon, or even an event in Germany, the Berlin Marathon, where you have athletes coming from other countries. Who is in charge of testing them? Is it the specific countries?
No, so that's a good question. And this is, you know, gets very complicated very quickly. These major marathons are all part of the World Athletics umbrella, I guess. So that's the, you know, the international federation that's responsible for athletics and road running. And so ultimately at those big events, World Athletics has the jurisdiction, and they are responsible for managing any results that come out of those events. But in terms of who collects them, the World Athletics will work with the major marathon or the race organizer to select someone to select a third party to collect the samples on site. So for the major marathons in the US, USADA is usually the sample collection authority. So we were just at the Chicago Marathon. We were at Boston earlier in the year, and we'll be in New York coming up. And so we are contracted to provide a gold standard service. So we are responsible for ensuring that the samples are collected, you know, to the highest standards with integrity and in accordance with the World Anti-Doping Code and the rules associated with that. And then we will ship the samples to a wider accredited laboratory. We have two in the US that we can choose from. But then the results of those are provided back to World Athletics, who have their own anti-doping unit, independent anti-doping unit called the Athletics Integrity Unit, and they will handle the results of that. So it can be a little bit confusing for athletes, particularly the US athletes who might be part of our registered testing pool. They might see the doping control officer one day at their house and they are there collecting on behalf of USADA, and then they will see them at the marathon and now they're collecting on behalf of World Athletics.
Okay, yeah, that does get quite complicated. And I'm assuming it's going to be easier to test athletes in the United States, but what if it comes to countries that are third world countries where it's difficult to navigate? What happens if an athlete misses a check-in and is not there? Is there any repercussions for that? Or does it just mean, okay, he missed one, he's just going to get a new appointment?
I guess to be clear, there's no appointments, I guess, with the out of competition testing. So a key part of that is that they're no notice tests. So the doping control officer will turn up unannounced and the athlete doesn't know that they're going to be tested. But usually in these third world countries, they will often have a national anti-doping agency, but they will have limited resources. So they're really looking to World Athletics and the Athletics Integrity Unit to go out there and test on their behalf. So I think, you know, not wanting to speak on behalf of the AIU, but they do a lot of testing in East Africa, you know, to help out the situation over there. And they would follow the same rules as the rest of the world. So if an athlete is part of the registered testing pool and then they're required to provide whereabouts, if they're not where they say they are, then the AIU will investigate and decide whether there is a consequence of missing that test. And if you miss three tests in a rolling 12-month period, then you can be sanctioned and have to miss out on future competitions for a period of time.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for explaining that. And my next question, I guess, to you is, when, you know, athletes and experts both talk about some sort of gray zone, which means, I guess, there are practices that might not be considered doping or are not as explicitly banned. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I've fully explained yet, but there's the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, publish every year a prohibited list, and that lists out all the substances and methods that are prohibited in sport. And so everybody who signed up to the World Anti-Doping Code, so that's all the Olympic and Paralympic federations and all the national anti-doping organizations, all the athletes that are part of those jurisdictions are all subject to that list. So if it's on the list, it's prohibited and you shouldn't take it. I guess where the gray zone may come into play is that, you know, science is always making advances, and so there are substances that may not yet be listed because they might be quite new, and we don't know the full extent of their power, I guess, in sport, and so they might not be on the list explicitly, and some athletes might be experimenting with those substances or methods, and technically, if it's not on the prohibited list, then they're not doing anything wrong. But is it really in the spirit of sport to be using such substances, particularly if 2 years down the track the substance then becomes on the prohibited list? So I guess that's one area where people might be talking about the gray zone. And then another one might be, you know, pushing the boundaries on some of the rules and manipulating them, I guess, to suit your situation. So in sport, there's a process known as a therapeutic use exemption, and that allows an athlete to take a normally prohibited substance to treat a medical condition. And there's a pretty strict process for applying for a TUE, and, you know, you have to provide medical justifications and really make sure that the athlete legitimately needs that medication. But of course, if they do, we don't want to disadvantage them. But there might be some athletes that are trying to game the situation for some of those in terms of a TUE and trying to use something that they might not, you know, 100% need from a medical standpoint. But, you know, on the whole, those athletes are few and far between, and the TUE process is quite rigorous, that often they won't be granted a TUE if it can't be shown that they actually really need one.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for spelling that out for us. And obviously this list is inclusive for amateur runners as well as elites. Is that right?
Yes. So a lot of the races, whether they're sanctioned by World Athletics or in the US if they're sanctioned by USA Track and Field, or even a lot of these newer, you know, trail and mountain running events, they will often list on the website and as part of the entry process that when you sign up, you are agreeing to abide by the world anti-doping rules and the prohibited list. And, you know, a lot of them will go as far as saying that you may be subject to testing as well. And so by entering, you are agreeing to abide by those rules.
Okay, perfect. All right. Thank you so much for explaining all this to us and your time and really diving deep into that. We appreciate it.
No worries. I hope it was helpful.
Thank you, Dr. Lewis, and thank you to the USADA for being available for this interview. And for you listeners, I hope that we clarified a lot of questions that you had, or maybe, you know, put some more questions in your head and now you have some answers. And another few things that came up off record once we had already stopped recording was that urine samples can be retained 10 years. And that is basically why a lot of these marathoners get popped afterwards, a few years afterwards, because there is so much new stuff out all the time. And while they can't go retro on new things that are banned, they can go back on stuff that they just find out with new testings, as long as the substance was prohibited at the time.
Yeah. So what you're trying to say is for substances that weren't illegal at the time that they did their race, they don't get in trouble for. But for substances that were illegal, they just didn't know how to accurately test for it, but they can now test for it, they do get in trouble for.
Thank you, Ryan, my native English speaker, for helping me with this interpretation. So that's exactly what I'm trying to say. And we're going to post a link on our website post, as well as in our podcast notes, to the list of prohibited items for 2024, as well as a global list of ineligible people from the Athletics Integrity Unit, which is really kind of interesting because you can see they're kind of arranged by country and what person is banned for how long. And it kind of also gives you a concept of how hard these agencies work behind the scenes. And we don't really know about that because unless it's one of the top runners, we likely won't hear about it in the news.
Yeah, given the money that's involved in sports, I no doubt understand how difficult their job really is, because money always brings the ability for people to elude, like testing and, you know, figuring out new ways to make new substances or whatever. So it's always, like I said before, it's like a game back and forth. It's almost like drugs coming from other countries too. It's, you know, there's so much money in drugs that it makes it really hard to stop it.
Exactly. So that's that. So that wraps up the episode on anti-doping. Let us know what you think about it. Follow us on Instagram because we always post on Instagram and we love interacting with you guys. Stay tuned for next week's podcast episode. We are putting together a everything you need to know about the New York Marathon, kind of like a hacks episode. Obviously, this will be my first New York Marathon, but as we've told you before, I'm not going to be the brains behind all of these answers to the questions. We're bringing you on a dietitian that tells us how to best navigate this course using fueling. And also we have Kristen Smith, who is a running coach on, and she has a lot of information. She's a native New Yorker and she talks about the course and what to expect. And we're going to answer some questions about how to just navigate that whole race weekend. So stay tuned for that.
Sounds fun. It'll get you excited for your race.
Absolutely. Let us know if you're coming to New York. And with that,
have a good week of running.
For tuning in. For more information and marathon running news, please head to www.marathonrunningpodcast.com and we'll be back next week.